From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Another week, another round of government officials raising their right hands. Between the televised hearings on Iraqi prisoner abuse and the televised hearings on the 9/11 Commission, it's easy to feel that we're privy to history in the making. But many more hearings happen behind closed doors. For example, in a closed session with the 9/11 Commission back in February, a former FBI translator named Sibel Edmonds described intelligence reports that crossed her desk in the summer of 2001. She later told The Independent of London that those reports included warnings that Al-Qaeda planned to fly hijacked airplanes into U.S. skyscrapers and included a general time frame for the planned attack. Her allegations were immediately picked up by news outlets around the world, but hardly at all here in the U.S., and the Justice Department is doing its best to keep it that way. It recently blocked Edmonds from testifying in a lawsuit brought by families of 9/11 victims, and this week it took the rare step of retroactively classifying information about her given to Congress almost 2 years ago. As of Friday, Edmonds' allegations had yet to appear in the Washington Post, but they did appear in the Post's online edition in a column by Jefferson Morley. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This past Thursday, the New York Times made its first mention of Sibel Edmonds' name. That story was headlined, "Material Given to Congress in 2002 is Now Classified." Did you see that piece?
Yes, I did.
Did it strike you as weird, Jeff, that the New York Times wrote a story about an extraordinary case of the government trying to retroactively classify something that was already a part of the congressional record, and yet the story about it never really discloses the substance of the allegations that the government is trying to quash?
It is weird. The problem is that there's a gag order on, and it works. I mean, the government has a gag order on her, so a lot of things she cannot talk about, and so it's harder for reporters to write about. That's the first part of why the full story isn't being aired in the press yet.
Aired in the press in the United States. The press in Europe seems to have felt unchastened by the uncertainties attached to a story where the primary source is gagged by the government. Why is that?
Everywhere but in the United States, people jumped on the story thinking, hey, this could be important. It was well covered in Latin America. In Europe, The Scotsman, a generally conservative paper, gave prominent play to Edmonds' charges, said that her allegations starkly contradicted the administration's claims. U.S. news organizations, and especially Washington reporters, for something with the political import of what she's saying, in order to sell a story in a newsroom, you need high-level sources to say, yes, you know, that's true. But nobody high up in the FBI is going to back it up at this point. It's nothing but trouble. And the 9/11 Commission members and the Senate staffers who talked about this story have been told not to talk about it. So that's where the gag order is working. Washington correspondents are going to back away, probably more so than foreign correspondents.
Jeff, I'm sure many of our listeners will see this episode as just yet another smoking gun, proof that the craven corporate-owned U.S. media are once again demonstrating they are lapdogs to the man. Is that really what's going on here?
I get a little impatient with people whose first instinct is to blame the press. It's a complicated and sensitive story, and we haven't seen the original documentation. But I think reporters are being excessively deferential to the executive branch. And it seems to me it's past the point where the executive branch gets the benefit of the doubt on a story like this. I'm hoping that people will begin to see that retroactive declassification is smoke, okay? And where there's smoke, there may be fire. Now, there's a third thing which is mitigating for journalists, too, which is we're in information overload about 9/11 stories. We have the commission hearings. We have Richard Clark. And so I think for some reporters, you know, they feel too busy to get to it. There's too much going on.
Although we're talking about advance intelligence that hijacked airplanes were going to hit the World Trade Center, this is not the kind of thing that people would just push to the bottom of their pile. That would be a blockbuster story if corroborated.
Yes.
All right, now you work at WashingtonPost.com. You have worked at the Washington Post, the print edition. How would you go about writing a story, given the institutional caution of major news organizations, that could adequately get Sybil Edmonds' charges out there without practicing bad journalism?
I think the way the story needs to be covered is around the legal action that's ongoing right now, because that's something that is not an allegation. The retroactive declassification is remarkable. The case law around these type of things is quite explicit. Under the Freedom of Information Act, for example, a declassified document cannot be reclassified ever for any reason. But I think that a little more transparency about what her allegations are and the conditions that she's under as far as the gag order, I mean, spelling that out is imperative. It doesn't have to be the lead of the story, but it should be in the story somewhere. Not to say that it's necessarily true or not, but to say that these allegations have been made by a serious person who is in the position to know sensitive information. The government has acknowledged that by putting a gag order on her. And so, therefore, it should be pursued. And hopefully it will be pursued.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Jefferson Morley is a staff writer for WashingtonPost.com.
Classifying documents retroactively may be highly unusual, but when the Justice Department blocked Edmonds from testifying in a 9/11-related lawsuit, it pulled a legal trigger that has become almost routine in the age of terror. It's called the state secrets privilege. That privilege has an interesting history, beginning back in 1948 when an Air Force plane crashed in Georgia. 9 men died, among them 4 civilians, and 3 of their widows sued. The government argued that releasing documents related to their deaths would threaten national security, and it won. In U.S. versus Reynolds, a new and enduring legal precedent was set by the Supreme Court. But now U.S. versus Reynolds is being challenged. The children of the dead have finally had a look at those half-century-old documents, and they say they can find nothing at all that relates to national security. They charge the government with a cover-up, and in so doing, suggest that the case that underpins the government's right to keep so many secrets is based on a fraud. In January, we spoke to Jonathan Turley, a professor at George Washington University Law School, and he explained exactly what precedent was set 50 years ago and what it meant.
What the court said was that trial judges needed to consider privilege arguments by the government, but the court also said that courts should struggle to remove only that evidence that clearly would violate national security. So the case itself really didn't give a hint of what it would become, because over the decades that followed, courts began to simply allow the privilege to be used almost unilaterally. A lot of district judges, frankly, don't want the headache of national security cases. And so when the government comes in with a silver bullet and says dismiss the whole case, a lot of judges are not complaining much.
And is it seen as a silver bullet generally in the legal community or just by government lawyers?
Well, frankly, when United States Reynolds comes around, you pretty much know the government's on the ropes. This is the thing that they pull out when their case is not going well or they found something enormously embarrassing in the file. I've actually been in a courtroom where Reynolds was invoked and people laughed. They actually invoked the privilege over a manual that was reportedly available on the internet, and reporters in the room were literally holding them up so the judge could see.
And the judge still went with the government.
Yes.
Well, let's go back to the original case. In Reynolds, the plaintiffs here are charging, the courts could have seen that the government was lying about its national security significance if it wanted to, and it simply chose to ignore it.
I think that is true, that the Supreme Court acted in what can only be viewed as willful blindness. At the time, it was abundantly clear to many that the Air Force was lying, that they could, in fact, produce this information, if not in the direct report, in a summary of the report. So then in 2000, when finally these memos appear, we have this line in the memo saying the aircraft is not considered to have been safe for flight. That was the conclusion of the report. Now, even if they had redacted the entirety of the report so that the basis of that conclusion is hidden, they should have at least produced that conclusion.
But the courts at the time decided that that report could be kept secret, and now we have Reynolds today. And how has it been applied in the prosecution of the government's war on terror?
Attorney General Ashcroft took every possible case to muster in support of his national security efforts. Well, Reynolds was ready-made for that. And now Reynolds has virtually become a stamp. I mean, any case that involves remotely the military or national security or, you know, poultry regulations, any type of civil liberties claim that's been brought since 9/11 has run right into Reynolds. And the government's come forward and said, look, we can't tell you whether we're beating detainees because it would reveal state secrets. Well, that's bloody ridiculous. I mean, if you're asking about whether detainees have been beaten, you're asking about whether a crime has occurred. That's not a matter of national security. It's a matter of criminal law.
So let's return to the current challenge to Reynolds, which is called Herring versus the United States. Where does it stand?
Well, the daughter of one of the engineers on that fateful flight uncovered this smoking gun, if you will, where the memo, which had no national security components, but a heck of a lot of embarrassing stuff to say about the Air Force. They filed with the Supreme Court and said, look, it appears that you were lied to. You created a whole doctrine on an act of deception. Well, not surprisingly, the Supreme Court declined to take it up. This is an enormous embarrassment for them as an institution. They then filed in the federal district court. And once again, the Justice Department is moving to dismiss that action. The troubling thing about these filings is the apparent lack of recourse when you find that the government lied, not in a small way, but in a way that created this massive doctrine. And if the district court dismisses this action, then there really isn't any deterrent to the government from lying. I mean, even when you can wave around a memo in which they clearly misled the Supreme Court of the United States, there's no recourse. Well, that's going to send one hell of a message to Justice Department attorneys.
Jonathan Turley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Turley is a professor at George Washington University Law School. 2 weeks ago, the case was addressed for the first time in 50 years in federal district court in Philadelphia. The judge is likely to rule next month on the government's request to dismiss.
Coming up, the many faces of Colin Powell and the politics of mispronunciation.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When NBC's Tim Russert interviewed Colin Powell from Jordan on last Sunday's Meet the Press, the big news was that a flustered State Department flack abruptly pushed the camera because Russert had exceeded his time, forcing other news outlets to reschedule their satellite feeds. But the real news was what Powell said about the evidence he presented against Saddam Hussein at the United Nations in February 2003.
Turned out that the sourcing was inaccurate and wrong, and in some cases deliberately misleading.
We all know that by now. The important part was that he said it. It was yet another strike against the administration in a public relations war waged almost from the moment President Bush made Powell the first member of his cabinet. Time Magazine, September 10th, 2001. On the cover, a portrait of the Secretary of State half in shadow. The headline, a plaintive question. Where have you gone, Colin Powell? By the cruel calculus of Washington, you are only as powerful as people think you are, Time observed. Powell's megastar wattage looks curiously dimmed, as if someone had turned his light way down. Still, according to a 2001 Gallup poll, roughly 85% of Americans regarded Powell favorably.
In fact, taking the Secretary of State job was a bit of a risk for him because he had an unbelievable image, sky-high approval ratings, more popular than the President of the United States. Colin Powell cares deeply about the image that he has.
Washington Post diplomatic correspondent Glenn Kessler says that it was because of that image that Powell found himself before the UN that February.
He was selected to give that speech because he was the most respected member of the administration around the world.
The material I will present to you comes from a variety of sources. Some are U.S. sources and some are those of other countries. Some of the sources
immediately after Powell's masterful presentation at the UN, a Newsweek poll showed the highest support for war in more than a year, a full 10% increase over 2 weeks earlier. And what happened after no weapons of mass destruction were found? His numbers gradually slipped into the high 60s, where they remain as of last month's CBS New York Times poll. That means that one of the most thwarted secretaries of state in history is still far and away the most popular member of his administration. Why does the public cling to its faith in Powell while the rest of the cabinet's numbers continue their downward slide?
Colin Powell is one of those media unshakables who, even when something resembling a negative image comes his way, it bounces right off better than Teflon.
Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page.
Colin Powell rose up in the 90s to prominence at a time when we really needed some black heroes. The man seems almost too good to be true, but we want him to be true. And he is a guy who fits the role. He has an unblemished record, wonderful family life, worked his way up, immigrant family. I mean, you name it. He's an iconic figure, larger than life. I mean, people tell me whether they like Powell's politics or not, they just can't get enough of him.
I began my research on the media management of the Secretary of State by plugging search words into the databases of LexisNexis and Google News. I tried Powell in polls, Powell in public opinion, Powell in the media, and pretty much came up with a zip about his image. Then I typed in Powell and good soldier. After that, the deluge. The phrase was everywhere.
Powell seems to be a tortured figure, you know, when it comes to this war.
New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman speaking last month on All Things Considered.
On the one hand, he was clearly the good soldier who marched in the direction that his leader ordered. At the same time, like many people, he clearly had misgivings about how complicated this operation would be.
The public knew about the good soldier's private torment because of a steady stream of press leaks, resulting in scores of newspaper accounts with unnamed sources attesting to Powell's lonely struggle for multilateralism. In May, a long piece in Vanity Fair chronicled the tug of war over his UN testimony. The June issue of GQ had a story about him called Casualty of War. GQ reporter Will Hilton said Powell's people encouraged him to write the piece and even supplied sources. One source, Powell's chief of staff Larry Wilkerson, is quoted as saying the secretary is tired, mentally and physically, and most likely would not serve a second term. But now the State Department is indignant. They say Hilton broke the rules, a charge that Hilton denies. Glenn Kessler.
They were upset because they said some of those interviews were not to be on the record. They were to be with no names attached. It raised a bit of a curtain on the process that the State Department has used to tell the story of Colin Powell in a way that is advantageous for him.
Kessler says the process involves seeding the press with comments from anonymous colleagues that the secretary can later deny if he chooses. Recently, he shrugged off some assertions made in Bob Woodward's book, Plan of Attack, for which Powell is widely assumed to have been a source. Thus, the story of Powell gets out, while he remains the good soldier. But as the public loses confidence in the White House, Powell has changed his approach by openly defying its policies, denouncing the UN speech he formally defended, condemning the recent actions of Ariel Sharon, stating that the president was fully informed of the Red Cross's concerns about Abu Ghraib long before the photos surfaced. But for all his dissent, the good soldier still declines to resign his commission, as he told Ted Koppel on Nightline.
If the president asked you, would you stay on for a second term?
I serve at the pleasure of the president.
Of course you do.
Period.
But serving at the pleasure of the president, I've heard you say that so many times that
because
I just want to...
Because it's the only standard answer you can give.
It's the only answer you can give without saying anything.
It's the only answer you can give that does not set people running off into a line of speculation and gossip that serves no purpose.
The public image of Powell is the straight-up guy, but the reality is he's also a real Washington operator.
James Mann, author of Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. He says the public also perceives Powell as a dove, but that's not entirely true either.
You have to keep in mind that this is a guy who was Ronald Reagan's national security advisor, who in the 1980s supported Star Wars, supported aid to the Contras. He took the lead in supporting American military intervention in Panama in 1989. He's a pretty hawkish guy within the general overall spectrum of American foreign policy. Personally, I think the public identifies him as a dove, but then can't quite figure out why he stays on in the administration when it goes off in different directions.
So you think the answer to the burning question, why didn't he leave, is simply that he didn't really disagree as much as the public thinks he did?
That's exactly right.
I think the public has short memories when it comes to the details.
Chicago Tribune columnist Clarence Page.
His iconic image is strong enough that it will weather this storm, just as he's weathered the storms of the My Lai controversy, of the Iran-Contra controversy, of the first Gulf War, where critics said he pulled out too soon, we should have gone all the way to Baghdad.
Page says Powell was a passive figure in those controversies. True, Powell drafted an official denial of what came to be called the My Lai massacre, but he said he didn't know the real story until much later. True, he knew about Iran-Contra, but he was on duty in Germany when the scandal broke. True, he didn't pursue Saddam to Baghdad in the first Gulf War, but he said no one favored that course. Page wrote in a recent column that Powell knows how to play the media as well as John Coltrane played the tenor sax. Nevertheless,
I like the man. I believe him. I believe that he is a man of character and integrity. In short, he's got my vote if he runs for president.
He's not the only one. Colin Powell is the very model of the principled outsider, even if he is a skilled operator and a dove, except when he's a hawk. A simple, complicated man who always seems to be telling the truth, even when he's saying nothing at all.
As we've heard, some people think Colin Powell is a tortured figure because he's unable to influence policy in Iraq. Others think the word torture should be reserved for actual torture, such as the detainees in Abu Ghraib prison were subjected to in Iraq. Still others believe that those detainees were not tortured, but simply abused, and that torture is something out of Saddam's dungeons or a scene from Marathon Man. In an op-ed in Newsday this week, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg mused over the invocation of the word torture, much as he examines the use and abuse of language in his new book, Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. He joins us now. Jeff, welcome to On the Media.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me.
All right, let's start with your title. It would suggest that words are being used by the government or by the government's critics these days as weapons of mass deception. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think language is always used in a way that can be deceptive. There's never been an age that was so wary of the dangers of linguistic manipulation or so on the alert against deceptive language. And at the same time, I think there's never been an age that was so easily manipulated by language. And in a funny way, those go together, I think.
Well, actually, you've anticipated my next question, because discussion of word choice has swirled so much during the last year or so. The president's use of the word crusade, the way he says nuclear instead of nuclear, the perversely named Patriot Act, freedom fries. Maybe it's not unusual for language to be manipulated in times of war, but do you recall a time when it's been is debated as much as it has been now?
What's new, I think, is that people are very alert to these little fillips of language, the way it can be tilted one way or the other, and at the same time, I think, very vulnerable. What advertisers learned a long time ago is that the more sophisticated you are, the easier it is to gull you into one or another position. It doesn't matter if you think you're hip to what's going on. Language still works on you.
Well, give me some examples of doublespeak that we recognize as doublespeak, but which nonetheless manages to press our emotional buttons.
For 6 months after 9/11, Bush was using the phrase evildoer like it was a kind of pronoun. You know, the evildoer said this, the evildoer said that. And it's something that people were aware of as a deliberate linguistic maneuver. But at the same time, it did frame the issue in a certain way of us and them, of good and evil and so on. That was nonetheless really important in shaping the terms of the debate about terrorism. There's another kind of language that, to my mind, or at least from a linguist point of view, is almost more interesting, which is the way certain suppositions and assumptions are built into the words we use. So that we don't question them, we don't think to ask, is that manipulative or whatever? You know, the other day, I did a search on the word values, and I looked in the New York Times and the Washington Post over the last 5 years, and it turned out that the phrase conservative values is anywhere from 4 to 5 times as frequent as the word liberal values. That is to say, values basically belong to conservatives. The word belongs to conservatives, even in the so-called liberal press.
You can actually co-opt our whole thinking process on how we respond to words if you're rigorous enough in invoking the same word again and again and again, staying on message, in other words?
Yeah, that's part of it. And part of it is the way these words just build certain assumptions. Take the phrase regime change. The interesting thing is that the word regime itself encodes a certain point of view. If you call something a regime, you are likely to mean that it's authoritarian. You also mean that in some sense it's unstable. It's the Latin Americans who have democratic regimes. In Western Europe, they don't have democratic regimes. They have democracies. It's just an assumption that's built into the word itself, which transcends these partisan distinctions that everybody's so interested in.
In one of the essays of your book, you make a distinction between linguistic gaffes that are either typos or thinkos. And you use as an example the president's mispronunciation of nuclear. Tell me more.
Nuclear is really no harder to pronounce than likelier. And what's more, this is a word that Bush's father pronounced correctly, that Bush would have grown up hearing pronounced properly, whether around the table in Kennebunkport, or when he was at Andover, or when he was at Yale. And at a certain point, I think it became for him a conscious choice. I call it a faux bubba pronunciation. To my mind, when somebody like that says the word, it doesn't count the same way it does when Homer Simpson says it as nuclear. It's rather a way of saying, you know, I got my finger on this button and I'll call these things whatever I damn well please.
We've spent a lot of time on this show considering the effect of the repeated use of shocking imagery and the effect of those images over time being denuded of their impact. Does that also happen with words? Are there powerful words that cease to be powerful through constant repetition and sort of sloganizing?
Certainly that happens to all words. I mean, it happens in two ways. On the one hand, a powerful word can be diffused, neutralized sometimes, and often that's a deliberate effort by one side to neutralize the power that another word can have. You can hear it in the way the right, for instance, has taken over, neutralized words like discrimination, bias, hate speech.
And leave us not forget terrorism.
Terrorism is a very powerful word that, you know, from its root had this notion of terror and in the early days of the sublime attached to it. It's just a word that has no real force anymore.
Everything is called terrorism, so is right. Therefore nothing terrorism anymore?
Well, there's something to be said for reserving those words for only things that merit them. After 9/11, for example, people were looking for language that would render the genuine horror and distress that they felt. And they'd go for these words. They'd say, oh, it was shocking, it was terrible, it was like a battlefield. And these were words that seemed to have been denuded of any power they might once have had. And particularly in a media environment that feeds on a kind of indignation and tries to turn every school board decision and every little injustice into an occasion for enormous indignation and horror and so on and so forth, the language necessarily just becomes washed out.
Well, Jeff Nunberg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Nunberg is the author of Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Time.
And now for a few of your letters. A few weeks ago, we spoke with medical anthropologist and marketing consultant Clotaire Rapai, who said presidential candidates need to tap into their reptilian brain to win. Listener Thomas Eckert wonders whether Rapai, quote, was sent here by the French as a means of vengeance for freedom fries. The philosophy of following your gut feelings is finally coming home to roost in the war in Iraq. The U.S. doesn't need yet another dose of this poison, unless we want to follow the fate of that fabulously successful group of reptiles known as the dinosaurs.
A correction from several listeners, including Robert Anderson of Brooklyn, New York. In your story about the Godzilla movies, he writes, you mentioned that Dodgers pitcher Hideo Nomo had the nickname Godzilla. Au contraire, Yankee slugger Hideki Matsui is Godzilla. And Richard Briette of New York City adds, great story, but one thing struck me about the gender aspect of Godzilla Everyone in the story referred to Godzilla as he. But wasn't he a she who later became a mother of Godzuki? Perhaps the only thing Godzilla can't break is the glass ceiling.
And an update. In March, we told you about a controversial series of TV news reports touting the benefits of the new Medicare law. Controversial because the spots were written and produced by the Department of Health and Human Services. They aired on over 40 local news programs with no hint that they were produced by the government. Democrats in Congress claimed that HHS money was being used illegally for a political public relations campaign, and the General Accounting Office, a nonpartisan arm of Congress, agreed to investigate.
On Wednesday, the GAO announced that the Bush administration had, in fact, violated the law by using taxpayer money to fund covert propaganda. The GAO has no law enforcement authority, but Democrats in Congress are working on a bill that would require the Bush-Cheney campaign to reimburse the money.
There's a link to the full text of the GAO report at onthemedia.org, and keep your letters coming to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. And please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Up next, the Brazilian media are mad at the American media, and the Indian media are mad at the Indian media. Plus, the Army's latest recruitment tool is only a game.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. With over 650 million voters, elections in India are an extraordinary exercise in democracy. Yet beyond the spectacle, this year's elections didn't seem too exciting. Unprecedented economic growth and warming relations with Pakistan seem to ensure a strong majority for Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee and his ruling party called the BJP. But as you probably know by now, the pundits and prognosticators got it very, very wrong. The Congress Party, led by Sonia Gandhi, came out victorious, and India has a new prime minister, Manmohan Singh. Shailaja Vajpayee is a columnist for the Indian Express in New Delhi, and she's been casting a critical eye on the Indian media during this whole drama. Welcome to the show.
Good evening.
So, India has had an explosion of media since the last election, more cable channels, more news in regional languages. With all these new ways to reach the people, first of all, why did Vajpayee fail to connect?
Just prior to the election, there was a government advertising initiative which stressed this India shining, feel-good factor that the economy was booming, that there was prosperity in the country. That kind of set the tone for what was going to come.
And India shining was basically the American-style slogan that was used by the BJP to promote their candidate and their party.
Well, yes, and, you know, it came from a suit ad. There was a Raymond ad which actually talked about looking good, and they coined it from looking good to feel good. So they actually took the slogan from an advertising campaign for suit.
And so was Vajpayee then trying to run an American-style ad campaign and it just didn't fly?
That's what becomes interesting. Mr. Vajpayee was meant to be the selling point of this government. And yet, you know, I've just been working on a study of the election coverage. And we have found that, in fact, in the first month, Mr. Vajpayee is missing completely from the media. And yet, he was their biggest asset. So there was something wrong there.
Why do you think they made that choice?
It's his age. He's not able to campaign any longer in the manner that he was. And, you know, again, on the media, we saw that very clearly. Then the media campaign of the BJP, which had actually taken the unprecedented form of even, you know, we were all getting phone calls from Mr. Vajpayee.
So you're saying that Vajpayee was actually used in an electronic phone campaign?
Yes.
What about Sonia Gandhi's campaign?
When we saw her on television, she was always amongst the people.
Right.
She was seen. And there was another important decision that she took this time, and I think that probably is very important at a level that we didn't know at the time, was that this year, she made a decision to give interviews to television. She made herself available to the media in a manner that she had never done previously. And she spoke in Hindi. It was very important.
Let's turn to the media now. They blew it as badly as Vajpayee, and yet they had correspondents everywhere. They had polls, and they were completely blindsided.
I think the major reason was that everyone in the urban centers, they all bought into the idea that, A, India was shining. So I think the media, which is also urban-based, they bought into that idea that this is really no contest. So should we go any further?
Why did the polls get it wrong?
I don't think we've still been able to understand that one. But I am going to suggest that I think some of the polls actually were not getting it so wrong. I feel that some of them did not want to come out with it for reasons of political and economic survival. I'll tell you something. After the second phase of polling, all the polls showed a drop for the ruling coalition, and the Sensex, that's the stock exchange, took a huge beating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was this immediate dip, and there was this terrible fear. Is the media leading to this? And in fact, there was a considerable criticism of the polls and suggests that they, in fact, were ruining the economy and making the stock exchange fall.
I think it says something for Indian democracy that even though the media are very influential and even though the media got it completely wrong, the people elected the candidate they wanted.
It's very interesting. I felt very good about this at the end. Everyone told us that this election is only being fought on the electronic media, and in future, it will always be fought on the electronic media. I think what's been very positive, perhaps, about this election is that, in fact, it's not going to be fought on the electronic media. It will be fought where it should be democratically fought, which is at the hustings and on the ground level.
Okay. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Okay, Brooke, thank you very much.
Shailaja Bajpayee is a columnist for the Indian Express. She spoke with us from her home in New Delhi.
Last week, Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva dropped his threat to give New York Times bureau chief in Brazil Larry Roeder the boot. Lula had ordered Roeder's expulsion after the veteran correspondent wrote an article suggesting that there was a national concern in Brazil over Lula's drinking. The Brazilian leader reversed his decision days later under an avalanche of protest from the Brazilian media and elsewhere on press freedom grounds. Keywords, on press freedom grounds. While fighting for Roeder's right to write, the Brazilian media were uniformly critical about the article in question. In fact, according to Brazilian journalist Antonio Brazil, many saw the episode as evidence of the decline and even corruption of American journalism.
One thing is to say anything about a president, you know, and his possible drinking habits. It's another thing when he says that the Brazilians were concerned, that there was a national concern. Most people say that was not, you know, true. His sources and evaluation in terms of putting together the story would represent some kind of a sloppy journalism, or maybe for those who were more into the conspiracy somehow, that there was something behind. You know, you cannot forget that this is a completely new government in Brazil. This is a socialist kind of a government for the very, very first time. Lula is from the Workers' Party, and they are very sensitive of any comment, especially coming from America. And you have to think that right now in Latin America, it's not just in Brazil, but in many parts of the world, the sort of idea of a very strong anti-American feeling.
I can see how an uninformed public might confuse suspicion with the United States government and its behavior with a newspaper that comes from the United States. But how would journalists in Brazil conflate the United States government's actions with that of the New York Times?
Bob, you have to think that when you start to show things that are wrong with recent American journalism, the whole situation of embedded journalism for Brazilians, you know, when they watch and they are sort of very well informed about situations like Fox TV, you know, supporting and being very much engaged in American politics and some of the problems that happened in the New York Times, you know, the frauds committed by Jason Blair, maybe the standards are not as high. So for the people to make this connection of political interest, of a conspiracy behind, you know, it's natural. If you're going to do a profile on the president and if you're going to accuse him, you have to do a much better journalism. You have to have better sources, different sources. And that was one of the main criticisms of the story, is that he listened to very few sources. Those sources were clear enemies of the government somehow. They are from opposition. And that would represent not the standards of American journalism that we expect.
I understand that this story, on the face of it, could be used as a weapon by President Lula's political enemies. However, journalism is not supposed to pay a whole lot of attention as to what will happen once a story is reported. Journalists are just supposed to find the news and report it come what may. Is it normal practice in Brazil to suppress stories for fear that they will be giving aid and comfort to some political party or another?
You have to see, Bob, this is a young democracy. You know, we are coming from years of dictatorship. You know, so journalists in Brazil, they are still learning their limits. To what extent, you know, can you criticize the president in power or the government in power? We don't have the same kind of independence of hundreds of years of democracy somehow that would make journalists bolder.
Well, I was going to ask you, if a Brazilian journalist had written the article that Reuter wrote, would there have been such an uproar? But I guess the question I want to ask you now is, would a Brazilian journalist at this moment in Brazilian history ever have written the article that Larry Reuter published in the New York Times?
Bob, there were a number of articles. What Larry did was just collect here and there little bits and pieces of stories that were in the Brazilian press. But again, it's one thing for the Brazilian press to comment and for a columnist to make an opinion. That would be very clear in Brazilian minds as being part of a political agenda, you know, because it's difficult to prove. But when the New York Times, which is a reference for Brazilian journalism and for international journalism in terms of standards, if he decides to write a story, if you read the story, it's not something that's just giving, you know, he drank three glasses or four glasses. It's very opinionated and reveals for the Brazilians, you know, some kind of a prejudice against, you know, someone who has a completely different background. You know, Brazilian journalists, they will never say, and that's the main difference in the New York Times, that was a national concern. Because Brazilians would take that, you know, like, we have a completely different culture, we have to understand carnival, you know. Your culture has a relationship with prohibition, and, you know, you cannot drink in the streets, which is completely alien for us. And that's, again, a problem of foreign journalism. You report from your own eyes and from your own culture things that are different that maybe you just don't understand.
All right. Well, Antonio, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Brazilian journalist Antonio Brazil is a visiting scholar at Rutgers University.
Last week, according to Wired magazine, a group of Army Special Forces troops staged a simulated assault in front of the L.A. Convention Center. It wasn't a preparedness drill for a potential terrorist attack. No, the troops were dispatched to promote the latest version of America's Army, a video game designed as a recruitment tool available for free download at GoArmy.com. When the first version of the game came out a year and a half ago, we asked a member of the Army's target audience to give it a try. Mark Delgado of Harlem, New York, one of WNYC's radio rookies, came back with this report.
I graduated high school 4 months ago, so right now I'm approaching a crossroads, and things could be a little foggy. I bet the Army would love to clear things up for me. I'm just not feeling the Army like that, but I'm willing to check out the game to see if it changes my mind.
What this is about. Let's see.
But the Army wasn't making it easy for me.
It's loading up a little slow, brother. It's loading up a little slow. Don't worry about it.
I tried for a few hours to load the game on my computer and couldn't. So I called WNYC computer expert Greg Mattias, and he couldn't get it to load either. And I was getting tight.
I want to play the game, man. How you go to gameplay, man? I don't like this.
Finally, after hours and hours of trying, we got the game to work.
Good morning, soldier, and welcome to the M16 qualification range. Today's task is to qualify with the M16A2 rifle. The conditions, you'll be given 40 targets. The standards, out of 40 targets, you must hit and engage 23 targets in order to qualify as a marksman.
In order to advance in America's Army, you have missions to complete as a soldier in training. and tests to pass, which include your accuracy with a gun, speed through an obstacle course, and the dreaded airborne test, where you have to parachute from thousands of feet in the air into a target circle. Each qualification board was 5 minutes. I played that game for 3 hours trying to qualify, so you know what that means. I had to try over and over and over again.
Welcome back to another day of qualification.
So after many, many, many rounds, I got the hang of it and qualified.
Congratulations, soldier. You qualified as a marksman in the United States Army.
That's right, baby. That's right. Then there was more qualification.
Make like a duck and waddle through that tunnel.
There was the obstacle course.
You just gave Hua a new meaning.
Infantry training and getting to know the burners. In my hood, that's what we call guns.
Today, you will get to fire the M249 squad automatic weapon, the M203 40mm grenade launcher, and you will get to throw the M67 frag grenade and the M83 smoke grenade.
Sounds pretty hot, right? This is the hottest burner of them all.
This is the M249 SAW, a 5.56mm fully automatic weapon. Can be magazine or belt fed. Has a maximum effective range for a point target of 800 meters and a maximum effective range for an area target of 1,000 meters.
I got used to the guns after repeatedly using them. Since this is an internet-based game, I play with people from other states as part of my unit, and I shot at people from places like California, kind of like an East Coast-West Coast rivalry. I was having mad fun.
Oh, but he shot me again. This game is hot.
But it's just a game. I'm not all of a sudden motivated to join the army. That's just me. So I asked my boy Dave if he thinks the video game is a smart move for recruiting.
Me personally, I will buy the game and disregard anything about recruiting. You feel me? Because the army, that's not really, you know what I'm saying, where I'm at. That's not where my head is at. I mean, video games. You know what I'm saying? It gets a little gimmicky. And it's, I mean, the army making a video game to recruit people, you know what I'm saying? That, nah, B, I just ain't feeling that.
Dave and I agree. Playing video games is playing video games. You leave it in the computer when you're tired of playing. But my other friend, Mike, feels the army has the right idea.
Just like when you got a football game, you play the football game, then it gets you hyped. You want to go outside and play football. So I guess that will work the same way. They play like a Navy SEAL game or military game, and then they'll get them hyped, and they might like it like that, and then they might want to join.
Sergeant First Class Eric Vidal, a recruiting officer in Harlem, says the game is instilling the values of America's soldiers.
It's not just about killing, because during this game, if you have rules of engagements and rules of war. So if you go into a mission, your job is to complete the mission with the least amount of force possible. Or you could wind up in jail. So, you know, you have those that go in there, and once they start firing up, they're going to find themselves penalized, and then they're going to have to start following the rules of engagement, the integrity, the values that we have in order to prosper during the game.
I don't know. If you give a teenager a video game with guns, he's going to shoot everything in sight. It's about busting shots to see if the guy looks real when he's dying. If you don't burst first, they're going to bust you and you're going to die. While I was talking to Sergeant Vidal, I had to ask about the part of the game that bugged me the most. The only part that I couldn't complete was the airborne.
Airborne.
The live jump. I didn't get it. I didn't know how to direct them to the circle. I just kept dropping.
The airborne, that's probably the best feature that we have right now. It's because it's so hard to dominate like the real life experiences. Like when you're coming off the tower in the airborne training, that is really the tower. And if you're ever in that situation and you do go to airborne training, you will see the trees just the way they are. You will see the tower just the way it is. I mean, they went to Fort Benning, Georgia. They shot the footage from all angles and they try to keep it true to life.
That's what I'm scared of. It's so true to life. I died 15 times in the game just trying to qualify. How could that encourage anyone? It's a really good game and I play a lot of them. I will play the game again without a doubt. But I was definitely not convinced to join the Army. And I have to say, if enlisting in the U.S. Army is as hard as downloading and installing the game America's Army, then the military's got some serious problems. For On the Media, I'm Mark Delgado III.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Rob Christensen our engineer. We had help from Derek John, to whom we bid a fond farewell. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.